Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back, and it is now or never, and that debt is fraud. And we've got a candidate that is a champion for the Constitution. He needs your help and support. It is all about full compliance with the Constitution. This is why we go through all these documents. So there's no question as to what the heck that line means in the Constitution. We want everybody to understand that these things were hard defined. As a matter of fact, what Wilson said in our show yesterday, as Sean read it, these are all well denned. Well denned, what does that mean? It's just an anechoic way of saying that they are well contained. They're well placed and contained so that, you know, they can't be misconstrued, or they can't be, you know, a portal to go down a different path, what have you. So anyway, so welcome back, Sean. Welcome back, and we are knocking out, looks like we're knocking the Pennsylvania ratification debates out of the park here. You're doing a great job.
Thank you, sir.
We were just talking about, you know, some woes I was having on my network. I go, what the heck's going on? And sure enough, all of my files got reshuffled in their placement because a particular drive got hung up or what have you. And long story short, I was just looking for this cotton-picking Pennsylvania debates, and it wasn't where it was in the order. You know how you have these things stacked? You know, when you go to a tab and it says, okay, it's just when you click on it, it'll bring it forward. And all of those things got shuffled because of that drive. But anyhow, folks, just sharing some information with you that, you know, really is irrelevant. And that's not what I usually do here, but hopefully we can keep the irrelevance out. And what we're going to talk about now is slavery. This is basically the same day. It's Iodium Dye evening. And I don't know what Iodium Dye means, but, you know, it's interesting that they were marking their dates and calendars that way back then. And actually, PM stands for what? I forget. Anyway, you know, I learned all that stuff a long time ago. Did you ever learn that? AM, PM?
No.
Oh, okay. Well, that's something that they should be teaching in school, so that you know. I mean, I believe it's all Latin, but they don't want people to know those types of things. I don't get it, but yeah, I do get it, but that's for another show. So let's go ahead and dive into this slavery thing, because I think this is going to be one of those that helps everybody understand what was really happening. So go ahead.
Alrighty, sir. I recollect on a former day the honorable gentleman from Westmoreland, Mr. Finley, and the honorable gentleman from Cumberland, Mr. Whitehill, took exceptions against the first clause of the ninth section, Article 1, arguing very unfairly that because Congress might impose a tax or duty of $10 on the importation of slaves within any of the United States, Congress might therefore permit slaves to be imported within this state, contrary to its laws. I confess I little thought that this part of the system would be accepted to. I'm sorry that it could be extended no farther, but so far as it operates, it presents us with the pleasing prospect that the rights of mankind will be acknowledged and established throughout the Union. If there was no other lovely feature in the Constitution but this one, it would diffuse a beauty over its whole countenance. Yet the lapse of a few years and Congress will have power to exterminate slavery from within our borders. How would such a delightful prospect expand the breast of benevolent and philanthropic European? Would he cavil at an expression, catch at a phrase? No, sir, that is only reserved for the gentleman on the other side of your chair to do. What would be the exaltation of that great man whose name I have just now mentioned? We may learn from the following sentiments on this subject. They cannot be expressed so well as in his own words. Volume 1, page 329. Quote, the colonies of France contain, as we have seen, near 500,000 slaves. And it is from the number of these wretches the inhabitants set a value on their plantation. What a fatal prospect, and how profound a subject for reflection. Alas, how inconsequent we are, both in our morality and our principles. We preach up humanity and yet go every year to bind in chains 20,000 natives of Africa. We call the Moors barbarians and ruffians because they attack the liberty of Europeans at the risk of their own. Yet these Europeans go, without danger, as mere speculators to purchase slaves by gratifying the cupidity of their masters and excite all those bloody scenes which are the usual preliminaries of this traffic. In short, we pride ourselves on the superiority of man, and it is with reason that we discover that this superiority in the wonderful and mysterious unfolding of these intellectual faculties. And yet the trifling difference in the hair of the head or in the color of the epidermis is sufficient to change our respect into contempt and to engage us to place beings like ourselves in the rank of those animals devoid of reason whom we subject to the yoke, that we may make use of their strength and of their instinct at command. Quote, I am sensible, and I grieve at it, that these reflections, which others have made much better than I, are unfortunately of very little use. The necessity of supporting sovereign power has its peculiar laws, and the wealth of nations is one of the foundations of this power. Thus the sovereign, who should be the most thoroughly convinced of what is due to humanity, would not singly renounce the service of slaves in his colonies. Time alone could furnish a population of free people to replace them, and the great difference that would exist in the price of labor would give so great an advantage to the nation that should adhere to the old custom that the others would soon be discouraged in wishing to be more virtuous. And yet, would it be a chimerical project to propose a general compact by which all the European nations should unanimously agree to abandon the traffic of African slaves? They would, in that case, find themselves exactly in the same proportion relative to each other as at present, for it is only on comparative riches that the calculations of power are founded.
Okay, so if you kind of go ahead, you'll find that he was citing, I think some of this was Montesquieu, because he talks about these different references above, and he starts off with both democracy. So if you kind of look at the very beginning, he's really citing all these different parts, and I think some of these had to do with Montesquieu, the Lycians, because he says here there's Montesquieu, in Lycia, and I have no idea. I think these are the different, because he's talking about these different pages, Necker on Finance. I'm pretty sure that this is Montesquieu that he's citing. So anyway. So he's making this analysis that using slavery does not benefit the state. Do you understand how that is? Can you explain that to me?
Yeah, because it creates oligarchy and it makes all the wealth into very few hands, and it takes away labor opportunities and ways for people to make a living from the people because they're getting free labor.
So let me ask you this.
And the currency, the economy, is money moving around from place to place.
Sure.
So if you have free labor where one person controls all the labor and they get all the profits, then it stifles the economy.
So do you see the benefit? Because is there a benefit to the state to have a mercenary force enforcing law or using a militia force in enforcing law?
I would think the militia force would be better because
there you go.
Then everyone's accountable to the law,
right,
instead of the law pitting itself against the people.
Right, and in addition to that, I'm trying to make this a very similar parable, or I should say comparison. You know, when you look at, you're absolutely right, having a free market system and allowing the, you know, because this is how corrections can be made. If, you know, if you're using slavery, it's only benefiting a very small class of people. But if you're using a mercenary force, it's only benefiting a very small class of people as well, because those people who are in control. But if you're actually requiring everybody to enforce the law, then now we actually have the liberty to challenge the laws we're enforcing, because it's incumbent upon us to do. And when it comes down to, am I going to go into my home and grab my family and drag them into court, or drag them and incarcerate them for a law that I believe, you know, is improper? If you have a mercenary force, it is easy to get bad laws enforced. You cannot enforce bad laws when you have to enforce it, because you won't do it. Does that make sense? So I'm just trying to make this parable.
Yes, sir.
That, you know, it's almost like, and another thing I like to say, when you create a mercenary, like a police force, when you create a police force, then you've created an instant argument that the people do not need guns, that the people do not need to defend themselves, that they will make sure that the laws and everybody's protected and so forth. Even though they know they'll fail, nobody can do it. You know, nobody can protect their family better than themselves. Nobody. Hands down. So anyway, all right. So let's look at the state constraints now.
All righty, sir. Permit me to make a single observation in this place on the restraints placed on the state governments. If only the following lines were inserted in this Constitution, I think it would be worth our adoption. Quote, no state shall hereafter emit bills of credit, make anything but gold and silver coin in a tender in payment of debts, pass any bills of attainder, ex post facto law, or law impairing the obligation of contracts. Fatal experience, end quote. Fatal experience has taught us, dearly taught us, the value of these restraints. What is the consequence even at this moment? It is true we have no tender law in Pennsylvania, but the moment you are conveyed across the Delaware, you find it haunt your journey and follow close upon your heels. The paper passes commonly at 25 or 30% discount. How insecure is property?
There you go. Now, this is one of the things that the ratification debates, because of this, is literally going to open up a snapshot of how screwed up life was under the Articles of Confederation just on currency and protecting your property, because they didn't have a stable currency. Every state had their own. They were all sovereign. And bottom line, when you went from one to another, they had different paper. And were you going to get, you know, the same value? No. And so the beautiful thing about the ratification base is it scrutinizes, even it looks at their own selves, because like when we look at Virginia and some of these other ones, they actually complain about how they, you know, how they implemented their and created these own problems themselves. So this is a great view, and I really highlighted these folks for you to start understanding one, the restrictions and limitations specifically regarding currency, because now we already see digital currency, cryptocurrency, these other things coming in when they don't have the authority to do anything other than create gold and silver coins. And it's one thing to have a paper bill to basically tie to a silver coin, to say we have the paper in currency, or the paper in circulation, we have enough coins distributed and what have you to easily cover those pieces of paper. There you go. So you don't have to walk around with, you know, your pants and your pockets being torn apart carrying all that weight and all that metal. especially if you're going to do a big purchase, buy a business or what have you. So being able to have the repository so that when you obtain that gold, that becomes your property. When we look at, and this is one of the things I like, helping people understand, is when you look at really everything you have, currency is the ultimate liquidation of your property. And so when they start playing with currency, they can inflate it by printing more and more of it. They're stealing your property. There's all sorts of things that go along with why they were to have a stable and a well-managed currency, the value thereof well-managed, so that, you know, you didn't lose your shirt. Today, it's ebb and flows. And actually, it's more flowing than anything else, because even though things may have gotten better a little bit, or the pain has got, it's only pain getting less, right? It's kind of like this one guy describes everything as, suckometer. Everything sucks. It's just the degree of sucking. And so there's this level of pain of everything that they're doing. And even though our currency, fluctuates and all these other things. By the way, let me do an aside. A few years ago, I told everybody to buy silver. I told everybody to buy gold. And if you did buy gold, you did buy silver, I think there's some people that probably rushed out when silver was hitting $150, $100, $120 for an ounce. I think those people that bought it when I was telling them to buy it, because this is what's going to happen. As things get inflated and things continue to go down this path, those silver coins, those gold coins, are going to be worth incredible amounts of money, just because that's how bad the inflation is. Now, will they correct these things? Yeah, but it's going to be shenanigans of how they do it, and it's not going to benefit you. Anyway, I digress. The whole point is that when we look at these restrictions, that they really identified some of the real problems regarding their currency. They don't go into bills of attainder and ex post facto laws and those types of things. But folks, if you look at what these things are, you'll understand why they added them, because they understood how governments could literally do some pretty nefarious things in making something that was absolutely legal all of a sudden illegal and come and arrest you for it. That's what they did in Nazi Germany. But anyway, I digress. Let's go to this next one, state constraints. I think that's what we just did. My bad. So the next day, December 7th, is when Japan bombed Pearl Harbor, but that hadn't happened yet. So let's
a day that will live in infamy.
Yeah, let's go ahead and dive into treaties here. Let's dive into that first one. Thanks.
The judicial power extends to all cases arising under treaties made or which shall be made by the United States. I shall not repeat at this time what has been said with regard to the power of the states to make treaties. It cannot be controverted that when made, they ought to be observed. But it is highly proper that this regulation should be made, for the truth is, and I am sorry to say it, that in order to prevent the payment of British debts and from other causes, our treaties have been violated, and violated, too, by the express laws of several states in the Union. Pennsylvania, to her honor be it spoken, has hitherto done no act of this kind, but it is acknowledged on all sides that many states in the Union have infringed a treaty, and it is well known that when the Minister of the United States made a demand of Lord Carmarthen of a surrender of the Western Post, he told the minister with truth and justice, quote, the treaty under which you claim those possessions has not been performed on your part. Until that is done, those possessions will not be delivered up, end quote. This clause, sir, will show the world that we make the faith of treaties a constitutional part of the character of the United States, that we secure its performance no longer nominally, for the judges of the United States will be enabled to carry it into effect. Let the legislatures of the different states do what they may.
So in this regard, he's talking about the observance and the compliance to a treaty. I wish he would have included while under their authority, treaties made under their authority, due to the fact that They just can't make a treaty and make it the supreme law of the land. And this comes up in the Virginia Constitution, or the Virginia debates. We won't find, I think, anything about it here. But anyway, let's move on to jurisdiction.
This will allow. This will also be allowed with regard to the following clause, quote, all cases of admiralty and maritime jurisdiction, end quote. The next is, quote, to controversies to which the United States shall be a party, end quote. Now I apprehend it is something very incongruous that because the United States are a party, it should be urged as an objection that their judges ought not to decide, when the universal practice of all nations has, and unavoidably must have, admitted of this power. But say the gentlemen, the sovereignty of the states is destroyed if they should be engaged in a controversy with the United States, because a suitor in a court must acknowledge the jurisdiction of that court. And it is not the custom of sovereigns to suffer their names to be made use of in this manner. The answer is plain and easy. The government of each state ought to be subordinate to the government of the United States.
Okay. Interesting. What do you think?
I can see where that makes sense in that situation.
He's looking at a legitimate situation
mm-hmm.
where there's something that is under the jurisdiction of the federal court because it arises under the Constitution and the United States is a party thereof. I'll give you a case in point, Maryland v. McCullough. Maryland v. McCullough was a case where the state of Maryland started assigning property tax on all property. And McCullough was, I think, the plaintiff, but whatever it was. The point was is that the federal government had installed or built a bank in Maryland, and Maryland wanted to tax the land to assess the value and to tax for the value of that bank sitting in Maryland. In other words, taxing the federal government, taxing them property tax. And that they couldn't do that because the government was there providing a service for Maryland. And so what should have happened, based on the Constitution, and I'm sure it did, I would think it did, but based on the Constitution, that was a needful building. And so for the federal government to possess a needful building, they needed to buy it, and the state legislature needed to agree to sell it to them. Then, per the Constitution, the federal government has all exclusive legislative authority over that land. That's exclusive, right? Means that they can't tax them. That's their land. And they make all the rules and everything regarding that land. So the fact that they were trying to tax them for having this bank, Marshall basically ruled that you can't do that. And he was right. But in that same ruling, Marshall came off, you know, with a sleight of hand and said, but, you know, it doesn't matter. The federal government has the supremacy in all things. In other words, he literally started broadening both the supremacy clause and the necessary and proper clause in many of his rulings, so that when people looked at, hey, if this federal government comes along and says you can't do it, then because we're supreme in all things, you can't do it. And that right there was sending a very bad message and setting a very bad precedent. So anyway. Then he goes through these two controversies between two or more states and between citizens, between a state and citizens of another state and on and on. And so he gets into this jurisdiction right here. So we're going into break with that quick keeping us from reading. We'll come back, Sean, and we'll pick up this next jurisdiction. There's a few jurisdictions here, but what we want to do is just kind of peg through these. There's one after this, and then there's a few more things that we've got. I think we've even got some more money, or some on money and so forth. So, folks, we'll be right back after the short promo. Thank you much.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so getting back to the next one, let's go ahead and pick up this next jurisdiction between citizens of a different state, of different states, and between a state and or citizens thereof and or foreign states and citizens or subjects. So, in other words, this is the part of the jurisdiction that the 11th Amendment got rid of, as well as, I think, a couple of others before. Let me just check real quick. I think between a state and citizens of another state. Yeah, so that the one above this was equally dealt with the 11th Amendment. And then the controversies between two states, between two or more states. So that one was maintained. So that's still under the federal jurisdiction. But the one after that, and then now this one, these are no longer under the federal court jurisdiction, just due to the fact that the states did not like the idea that the federal government was going to be able to pull in. Now, as you know today, folks, when you read this and you read the 11th Amendment, it does not mean that the federal government is not pulling these cases in, because they are. In other words, they don't have jurisdiction, but they've reassumed it, and nobody's challenging it because nobody says, hey, you don't have jurisdiction anymore, because somewhere down the line between the Civil War and today, there was a redefining of the 14th Amendment, where the 14th Amendment basically stated, in some justice, basically made an edict that the 11th Amendment, those restrictions on the 11th Amendment's jurisdiction, is no longer applied because of the 14th Amendment. I mean, the 14th Amendment has been really subverted. The justices have used it as a tool to subvert what they can do, what they can't do, by redefining it and redefining other laws and so forth, by using it as a fulcrum. Hopefully that's better, so people can see that they're using it as this either a wedge or a fulcrum for their advantages. And so anyway. And that's not the whole point of the 14th Amendment. It wasn't designed to do those things. So let's go ahead and go into the jurisdiction here.
Between citizens of different states and between a state or the citizen thereof and foreign state citizens or subjects, end quote. This part of the jurisdiction, I presume, will occasion more doubt than any other part. And at first view, it may seem exposed to objections well-founded and of great weight. But I apprehend this can be the case only at first view. Permit me to observe here, with regard to this power or any other of the foregoing powers given to the federal court, that they are not exclusively given. In all instances, the parties may commence suits in the courts of the several states. Even the United States may submit such decision if they think proper. Though the citizens of a state and the citizens or subject of foreign states may sue in the federal court, it does not follow that they must sue. These are the instances in which the jurisdiction of the United States may be exercised, and we have all the reason in the world to believe that it will be exercised impartially. For it would be improper to infer that the judges would abandon their duty, the rather for being independent. Such a sentiment is contrary to experience and ought not to be hazarded. If the people of the United States are fairly represented and the President and Senate are wise enough to choose men of abilities and integrity for judges, there can be no apprehension. Because, as I mentioned before, the government can have no interest in injuring the citizens.
Well, at the beginning, but then when it's certain citizens, it's okay. As a matter of fact, they started injuring the minorities. And then once the minority shifted, they went after the majority because of, you know, guilt or what have you. But anyway, I digress. Again, this got wiped out by the 11th Amendment because they didn't like the federal government just even having any ability to hear appeals or what have you. So, bottom line, these things between a citizen of another state and, you know, a citizen of a different state, suing a state, and our foreigners and so forth and so on, all of this has been obviated. They can't, they don't have jurisdiction. And then they redefined it, and that's why when you actually see every case in the world gets into, can get into the federal docket. How does that happen? Well, because they want that ability. They want, you know, just even though these cases that they, you know, people apply every year to have their case heard with the Supreme Court. And most of all these cases, they don't have jurisdiction. But the people, the defendant or the prosecution, whatever, whoever's grinding the axe and wants to pay the money to do that, that's exactly what they do. They put it in there so that, hey, I hope they, you know, take this so that they can make new law to protect my cause. Because that's what a judiciary form of government does. And they don't handle everything. There's a lot of stuff that they never pick up. Like Bob Schultz's First Amendment petition lawsuit, where he was suing to get the government to, you know, to basically, if you petition government for redress and the government refuses to redress your, you know, your petition or address it and redress it, then you have a right to basically be relieved of taxation, because that was written into law when the United States stood up. And if you look into the history of all of this, folks, you go, oh, well, the courts, when they realized that that's actually the case, they just swatted at it and said, well, we just think that's a tax evasion scheme. You're just, you know, trying to throw this tax evasion scheme out there, and we're not going to recognize that. So they basically treated that whole lawsuit and what Bob Schultz was doing with, you know, I'll just say insulation. They didn't want to pick it up. They didn't want to hear it. And they, so far they haven't. And I don't know what the cost is to file every year, but it just costs money. Let's go into now the commerce, and then there's this jurisdiction next again. There's commerce. Actually, it's technically, yeah, it is commerce. I just didn't have it highlighted, but there's this short little note on commerce before the next jurisdiction. Let's get that.
It is not an important object to extend our manufacturers and our commerce. I'm sorry, I read that wrong. Is it not an important object to extend our manufacturers and our commerce? This cannot be done unless a proper security is provided for the regular discharge of contracts. This security cannot be obtained unless we give the power of deciding upon those contracts to the general government.
Okay. So
I will mention,
go ahead, keep going.
I will mention further an object that I take to be of particular magnitude, and I conceive these regulations will produce its accomplishment. The object, Mr. President, that I allude to is the improvement of our domestic navigation, the instrument of trade between the several states, private credit, which fell to decay from the destruction of public credit by a too inefficient general government, will be restored. And this valuable intercourse among ourselves must give an increase to those useful improvements that will astonish the world. At present, how are we circumstanced? Merchants of eminence will tell you that they cannot trust their property to the laws of the state in which their correspondents live. Their friend may die and may be succeeded by a representative of a very different character. If there is any particular objection that did not occur to me on this part of the Constitution, gentlemen will mention it. and I hope when this article is examined, it will be found to contain nothing but what is proper to be annexed to the general government. The next clause, so far as it gives original jurisdiction in case of affecting the ambassadors, I apprehend is perfectly unexceptionable. It was thought proper to give the citizens of foreign states full opportunity of obtaining justice in the general courts, and this they have by its appellate jurisdiction. Therefore, in order to restore credit with those foreign states, that part of the article is necessary. I believe the alteration that will take place in their minds when they learn the operation of this clause will be a great and important advantage to our country. Nor is it anything but justice. They ought to have the same security against the state laws that may be made that the citizens have, because regulations ought to be equally just in the one case as in the other. Further, it is necessary in order to preserve peace with foreign nations. Let us suppose the case that a wicked law is made in some one of the states, enabling a debtor to pay his creditor with the fourth, fifth, or sixth part of the real value of the debt. And this creditor, a foreigner, complains to his prince or sovereign of the injustice that has been done him. What can that prince or sovereign do? Bound by inclination as well as duty to redress the wrong his subject sustains from the hand of perfidy, he cannot apply to the particular guilty state, because he knows that, by the Articles of Confederation, it is declared that no state shall enter into treaties. He must therefore apply to the United States. The United States must be accountable. Quote, my subject has received a flagrant injury. Do me justice or I'll do myself justice, end quote. If the United States are answerable for the injury, ought they not to possess the means of compelling the faulty state to repair it? They ought, and this is what is done here. For now, if complaint is made in consequence of such injustice, Congress can answer, quote, why did not your subject apply to the general court, where the unequal and partial laws of a particular state would have had no force? In two cases, the Supreme Court has original jurisdiction that affecting ambassadors and when a state shall be a party. It is true it has appellate jurisdiction and more, but it will have it under such restrictions as the Congress shall ordain. I believe that any gentleman possessed of experience or knowledge on this subject will agree that it was impossible to go further with any safety or propriety, and that it was best left in the manner in which it now stands. Quote, in all the other cases before mentioned, the Supreme Court shall have appellate jurisdiction, both as to law and fact, end quote. The jurisdiction as to fact may be thought improper, but those possessed of information on this head see that it is necessary. We find it essentially necessary from the ample experience we have had in the courts of admiralty with regard to captures. Those gentlemen who, during the late war, had their vessels retaken, know well what a poor chance they would have had when those vessels were taken in their states and tried by juries, and what a situation they would have been if the Court of Appeals had not been possessed of authority to reconsider and set aside the verdicts of those juries. Attempts were made by some of the states to destroy this power, but it has been confirmed in every instance. There are other cases in which it will be necessary, and will not Congress better regulate them as they rise from time to time than could have been done by the convention? Besides, if the regulations shall be attended with inconvenience, the Congress can alter them as soon as discovered. But anything done in convention must remain unalterable but by the power of the citizens of the United States at large. I think these reasons will show that the powers given to the Supreme Court are not only safe, but constitute a wise and valuable part of the system.
Now, I'm going to tell you right now that there is so much stuff here that it would require really going through this line by line and in clarifying, you know, why he's making these arguments for what he's saying. As we look at, and this is the whole, because the one thing that's not stated here, but it's actually stated in the Article 1, Section 8 in the powers, in the list of granted powers, that all citizens are under the U.S. jurisdiction. In other words, they're under the federal jurisdiction if they commit a crime on the high seas, a misdemeanor crime, and or they commit a crime against the laws of nations. In essence, they did this not to assume power, but they did this to protect the citizens of the United States, because if a citizen is being charged in another nation against a crime committed against that nation, then who is to defend it other than the citizen themselves? Therefore, instead of being alone in a foreign court, if you've committed a crime and you're accused of a crime and arrested for a crime, the federal government has the constitutional responsibility to step in on your behalf. That's why that was done, to ensure that the people were protected. It's the same thing to protect the federal government's responsibility over trade and over contractual agreements and so forth. So as we look at these treaties, everything else, there's so many other little things in play, because technically, can a state make a treaty with a foreign nation? No, it can't. Under the Articles of Confederation, they couldn't. But under the United States Constitution, they can't. And if they do, they could get punished. But we're going through, but there are these treaties that exist. There are things in motion. So eventually, when all trade agreements and everything else shifts back, or I should shifts fully into the hands of the federal courts, the federal government, I should say, not courts, then those treaties that are expired or no longer in force at the state, between a state and a foreign nation or foreign corporation, bank, what have you, then those treaties will basically die on the vine. But there needed to be a mechanism to be able to ensure that justice could be provided for the foreign states and the foreign interests. This kind of goes to the same point of why all, because they, what is it in the Constitution? I got it right here. Color-coded Constitution. And I believe it basically says, what is in Article 4, I think, full faith and credit shall be given in each state to the public acts, records, and judicial, blah, 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 the manner. And so, actually, no, it's in Article 1, where the federal government has full faith and credit. And, you know, basically can go out and obtain treaties, loans, what have you. Only they can do that. And the reason that they did that was they wanted to make sure that included in that language was that all previous obligations with foreign states were going to be equally recognized in this new government. So if you read that part where they talk about the full faith and credit of the United States will, you know, remain and will be within the Congress, the point is that they were trying to make sure that there was no apprehension with foreign nations moving forward, that just because we changed our Constitution and everything else, it has no effect on the execution and the fulfillment of those contracts. So, because that was big. I mean, if America was going to do business after changing its government from the Articles of Confederation to this, and you've heard me say this, that these cabals, they were all creating their own advantages. This was sending a signal that those cabals couldn't do this anymore, and that's true, precisely true. And that was the point. And so that's one of the reasons why, for that and those very specific purposes, they needed that jurisdiction, and they needed to declare these things, because if not, there would have been probably a lot of foreign nations and corporations, what have you, that would have said, you know what, I don't think I want to do dealings with the United States. They're not honoring their old deals, and they're making changes that actually, you know, we can't deal with these other, you know, these other states and so forth. And they needed to address all of that in this. Hopefully that makes sense. And why these cases were literally laid at their feet for those specific purposes. Anyway, let's go into the next one. I have to pull it up. What do we got is jurisdiction, right? Is that one we just read? I think so. Yep. So slavery is the next one, actually. Thank you.
The Honorable Gentleman from Fayette, Mr. Smiley, the other evening claimed for the minority the merit of contending for the rights of mankind. And he told us that it has been the practice of all ages to treat such minorities with contempt. He further took the liberty of observing that if the majority had the power, they do not want the inclination to consign the minority to punishment. I know that claims self-made form no small part of the merit to which we have heard undisguised pretenses, but it is one thing to claim, and it is another thing, very different indeed, to support that claim. The minority, sir, are contending for the rights of mankind. What, then, are the majority contending for? If the minority are contending for the rights of mankind, the majority must be contending for the doctrines of tyranny and slavery. Is it probable that that is the case? Who are the majority in this assembly? Are they not the people? Are they not the representatives of the people as well as the minority? Were they not elected by the people as well as the minority? Were they not elected by the greater part of the people? Have we a single right separate from the rights of the people? Can we forge fetters for others that will not be clasped around our own limbs? Can we make heavy chains that shall not cramp the growth of our own posterity? On what fancy distinctions shall the minority assume to themselves the merit of contending for the rights of mankind? Sir, if the system proposed by the late convention and the conduct of its advocates who have appeared in this house deserve the declarations and insinuations that have been made concerning them, well may we exclaim, quote, ill-fated America, thy crisis was approaching, perhaps it was come, thy various interests were neglected, thy most sacred rights were insecure. Without a government, without energy, without confidence internally, without respect externally, the advantages of society were lost to thee. In such a situation, distressed but not despairing, though desirous to reassume thy native vigor and to lay the foundation of future empire, though selected a number of thy sons to meet together for the purpose, the selected and honored characters met, but horrid to tell, they not only consented, but they combined in an aristocratic system calculated and intended to enslave their country. Unhappy Pennsylvania, thou, as a part of the Union, must share in its unfortunate fate. For when this system, after being laid before thy citizens, comes before the delegates selected by them for its consideration, there are found but three of the numerous members that have virtue enough to raise their voices in support of the rights of mankind. End quote. America, particularly Pennsylvania, must be ill-starred indeed. If this is a true state of the case, I trust we may address our country in far other language. Quote, happy America, thy crisis was indeed alarming, but thy situation was not desperate. We had confidence in our country, though on whichever side we turned, we were presented with scenes of distress. Though the jarring interests of the various states and different habits and inclinations of their inhabitants all lay in the way and rendered our prospect gloomy and discouraging indeed, yet such were the generous and mutual sacrifices offered up, that amidst 42 members who represented 12 of the United States, there were only three who did not attest the instrument as a confirmation of its goodness. Happy Pennsylvania, this plan has been laid before thy citizens for consideration. They have sent delegates to express their voice and listen, with rapture listen, from only three opposition has been heard against it. The singular unanimity that has attended the whole progress of their business will, in the minds of those considerate men who have not had the opportunity to examine the general and particular interests of their country, prove to their satisfaction that it is an excellent constitution and worthy to be adopted, ordained, and established by the people of the United States. After having viewed the arguments drawn from probability, whether this is a good or a bad system, whether those who contend for it or those who contend against it contend for the rights of mankind, let us step forward and examine the fact. We were told some days ago by the honorable gentleman from Westmoreland, Mr. Finley, when speaking of this system and its objects, that the convention, no doubt, thought they were forming a compact or a contract of the greatest importance. Sir, I confess I was much surprised at so late a stage of the debate to hear such principles maintained. It was a matter of surprise to see the great leading principle of this system still so very much misunderstood. Quote, the convention, no doubt, thought they were forming a contract, end quote. I cannot answer for what every member thought, but I believe it cannot be said that they thought they were making a contract, because I cannot discover the least trace of a compact in that system. There can be no compact unless there are more parties than one. It is a new doctrine that one can make a compact with himself. Quote, the convention were forming compacts, end quote. With whom? I know no bargains that were made there. I am unable to conceive who the parties could be. The state governments make a bargain with one another. That is the doctrine that endeavored to be established by gentlemen in opposition, that state sovereignties wish to be represented. But far other were the ideas of the convention, and far other are those conveyed in the system itself.
Okay. So this right here, and if we read a little further, and, you know, I would basically tell everybody, read further. Because even in this next paragraph, he starts talking about, and I didn't want to poison the pool, but I kind of said that Mr. Wilson has a real predilection towards we the people and more of a fondness towards what, when we hear we the people, we, what we're looking at is a democracy. When we place context to those terms and the how he's talking, you know, the powers in the people. I mean, you've already read parts where he's actually said things like that. And so here is one of those points that the question is this a compact? Mr. Wilson is clearly stating that he's not aware of it being a compact. What do you do? Let's look at it this way. What they're doing right now is they're engaged in what they call a ratification debate. Now, Sean, what does ratification mean?
Agreement to terms.
So it is a formal process. It's a legal formal process of accepting a contract, compact, or treaty. Okay, so interestingly enough, we just ran out of time. And so we'll come back and talk about how Wilson, apparently, what he's saying isn't redefining the fact whether the Constitution is a compact or not. He is just completely, probably just ignorant. Doesn't matter. It's not providing a definition. He's basically telling you this is what I believe. But we'll cover this in more detail. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.